philosophers in space.
Season 2, The Beardening.
Season 2, Cry Harder.
Season 2, Queer-Coded Dark Universe Edition.
Season 2, Lovecraftian, Cronenbergian, or Dickian Boogaloo.
I had Season 2, Buggane is Boogaloo. I love it.
Season 2, Enter the Naked Time.
Season 2, fully solar-punked, ethically sourced pansexual space socialism. It's just the culture. We're just the culture now, is what I'm saying.
Welcome back to Philosophers in Space, friends. I am Captain Callie Wright, joined by my probably not exactly a bridge function, but is still on the bridge and a bridge officer anyways, ethics officer Aaron Rabinowitz. Hi, Aaron.
How you doing? You get a lot of ethics calls around here. You know, it's better to keep me at hand, or at tentacle, as it were, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when I've got a big, important decision to make, when I meet, for example, a new non-humanoid alien species, and I'm like, hey, how do we navigate this whole thing? It's just quicker to have you there instead of, you got to get on a turbo lift, and there's a whole lot of decks right. You got to make it through. I get it.
The whole thing. Yeah.
No, I am excited. You know why I'm excited, Aaron?
Why are you excited?
Because we're going on an adventure.
We are going on an adventure, Captain. The creepiest phrases in all of science fiction. Let's do a thing. Let's go on an adventure. Yeah, no, I'm super excited. In honor of our adventure, I have fully embodied the octopi dream. I am all arms on this one. I am ready to go. Let us do the thing.
And for those who can't see, I can see the colors of your skin fluctuating with your emotional state.
Yeah.
That's a thing
right,
that's happening.
That's not just like the hallucinogens you take before our recordings. That's a completely separate external effect. Absolutely.
So a little bit of housekeeping before we get started. We've been doing a Patreon drive, and doing the updates about that per episode is a little weird because the time when we record versus the time when the episode goes out, sometimes there's a bit of a distance between that. And so we don't want people to think that we have forgotten about them or are ungrateful. So we are going to thank some folks, and we just want to let you know it's not that we forgot about you or anything like that. It's just that thankfully, the kind of show that we do, it's not a thing where it's like we're recording tonight and it comes out tomorrow and we got to like always be on top of things. So,
right.
But we met the goal. So just like the we met our first goal, I should say.
First goal.
And so this episode, like the second Q&A episode that we will have put out before, are going to be a little longer. You all got us there and we are deeply appreciative.
Yeah, we're going to have a little extra tentacle room to stretch out in. And yeah, so we're going to do the pledge drive. Keeps going, of course. You know, we've got other goals we want to get to, and we may have achieved them by the time you hear this. Who knows? And if we have, great. We will have sent out messages through faster forms of communication temporally. And here you'll just be already enjoying the fruits of whatever labor that was. I did want to make a specific announcement, though, and we'll share this out in other spaces as well. But this was a particularly cool thing that one of our patrons has decided to do as part of the pledge drive. One of our still pretty sure not an AI, but we're mostly pretty sure not an AI patron, Jesta, has offered to sponsor a couple of other patrons at the like basic $2 After Dark level, which I think is super cool, and we're sympathetic and we want to help out with that. And it's a great way, you know, to grow the community, I think, for people who really can't afford it but want to hear that extra little bit of tentacle goodness. What we'll do with that, I think we figured the idea will be, if you want to get access, we have currently, you know, 5 sponsored patrons essentially at the $2 level. And if you email us at philosophersinspace.com, you will, right? I don't know, philosophersinspace. Email us at our email address.
philosophersinspace@gmail.com.
There you go. Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm here for you.
Email in there somewhere. Thank you, Captain. Then, yeah, we will, hand those out to the first 5. And if other folks are interested in doing something like this, you know, let us know. And we will count this, you know, towards the overall patron total. So I think probably we'll do that by, like, reducing the number of patrons needed. So we'll reduce the goal of our puppy hangout party slightly, if that one hasn't already been achieved, or whatever's up next.
Yeah, yeah. So just, you know, a little content creator transparency. Obviously, we would love for just, like, everything to be free forever, always. But, like, we have to do a little bit of commerce to make it possible because, you know, we have bills to pay and stuff. And that's a thing that Aaron and I do honestly spend a lot of time talking about is, like, how do we balance making sure that we're not being, like, give us money or F you. Like, we never ever want to be like that. And so it's just, it's cool to know that, like, there are other folks who are just like, you know, we want to be a part of helping that. And because, you know, it, After Dark's a lot of fun, and I want folks to experience that along with everyone else. So just super, super cool, like, legitimately appreciative. Aaron was like, hey, go check out the message in our Patreon inbox. And I was like, oh, huh, cool. And I figured, you know, I figured it would be some nice feedback about episode or something like that. And I was like, yeah, cool, that'll be neat to read. And I read that, and I was just like, damn. Like, people are cool. People
would have been awesome as if Patreon allowed us to have a $0 level for sponsored patrons, but of course Patreon does not allow that. So you'll have to email us and we'll do an RSS feed for you and et cetera. Yeah. Cool. All right. So I think that's pretty much everything, except we'll say briefly, we're doing the second book in the Children of Time series. We did 3 episodes on Children of Time back in the previous season. If you want, I would recommend going back and listening. I think they are 3 of the strongest episodes that we did in the before Cali times. You know, one of my favorite books of all time, Children of Time. So definitely check that out as well. And we'll do a little bit of, like, catching up on it, but we're not going to spend all of our time on that time. And we're going to move on to the future time.
Yes. Yeah. So does that mean it's time for is it time to plot me?
The future time, and then we'll go back to the past time, and then we'll do the future time again, and then we'll sync it all up at the end times, basically, right? So yeah, I guess let's go ahead.
I don't even know what words you just said, Aaron. You just threw a whole lot at me right there.
Plot me? I think plot me. Plot me.
So the answer is yes, plot me.
Yeah, it was a bunch of complex characters thrown into heavily serialized battles, which always ended in mind-blowing twists and made me question the basic tenets of my reality.
So a little bit of personal plot with this book. So I just need to say that this book has given me a precious gift. Aside from just being a really great book, it has given me a specific friendship dynamic gift that is a thing I love being on the receiving and giving end of. So whenever I meet someone new and I figure out that we have, like, music interest in common, for example, I'll invite them to, like, hey, come see the show with me. It's, like, one of my favorite bands of all time, all of that sort of stuff. And I always end up having to have a little bit of a talk with a person like that. It's like, you will see me lose all pretense of social obligation at a show where it's, like, one of my favorite bands. So, like, you're going to see a different side of me. Right. I'm going to be, like, dancing and yelling and screaming and probably crying. And it's a whole thing. Like, every single filter that I have, it just goes completely out the
window. Do you want to share which band you're thinking of when you think about you're completely losing control?
Thrice, Circus Survive, and the Menzingers are, like, my top 3.
I don't know any of them.
It's like emo, post-rock, indie. Cultural exchange. Yeah. So all that's to say that it's a fun thing for me to be able to share with other people that side of myself. And I feel like this book has given me that gift of seeing Aaron in that state.
Let's see. Yeah. You know, between, like, this and, like, the book High Weirdness, you know, that's probably everything you would need to comprehend me as a person, as a construct.
Because I remember I saw a random YouTube video that mentioned this book, and it was an interesting thing of, like, who's to say if we meet an alien species, we would even be able to communicate with one another, because how would we know that we conceptualize the universe in the same way, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, oh my God, that's really cool. And so I sent Aaron a text and I was like, oh my God, have you heard of this book? Not knowing.
Right.
And he was like, oh yeah, you know, like, we could probably do a book on, or an episode on the sequel, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, cool. So, like, I started jumping into it and I'm gushing about the plot a little bit. And then Aaron sends me back a text that I'm like, wait a minute, is Aaron, like, into the spiders? Is that, am I kid? Oh, okay.
So, in my defense, the book is into the spiders. I'm just picking up on the vibes.
Absolutely.
You know? Like, I'm just understanding why the book is buying the spiders drinks all night long.
Right. And not a critique by any stretch of the imagination. I thought it was fantastic.
super hot. I'm not gonna lie. If you go back and listen, it was our horniest on Main, certainly for previous episodes, you know, including the Cronenberg episodes.
So I guess, you know, a brief recap is in order of what the story is about for folks who may not be familiar or, you know, for folks who, for whom it's maybe been a minute, because since the meat of what we're going to be talking about is the sequel, it's actually been a minute from the first book for me, too. So the notion is humanity is expanding out into the galaxy, and one of the ways that they have chosen to do that is they have terraformed planets throughout the galaxy, and they have decided to create an uplift virus to get these apes to eventually evolve to roughly where we are in our state of interaction with the universe, which... Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe this is a philosophy section question, but I'm just like, why would you do that instead of just sending humans to the colonized planet? Like, it seems like extra steps to me.
Well, in this particular case, if you're Kern, it's because you absolutely hate humans.
Well, okay.
And do not want them anywhere near your Eden at all. And really, in the case of Desi, too, it's also just like, humans are bad, objectively so.
Yeah.
And can you blame them?
Yeah, I was just about to say, I don't even entirely disagree.
No, it's a very sympathetic perspective.
As we'll find out, the humans across all of these are definitely the characters that I am rooting for the least.
Worst, the B-est of B-plots. You just couldn't wait for them to cut away harder.
Yeah. There's some I guess eco terrorist fanatic folks who decide to throw a wrench in the works, and we end up uplifting spiders, wonderful, beautiful spiders who
anti-transhumanism gets us the best transhumanist ending ever.
Mm-hmm. And we see the rise of a spider civilization, and there's just so much cool world building that happens. I think. Something that turns a lot of folks off from sci-fi sometimes is that level of world building where there's, in terms of story beats and like, mm-hmm. you know, things moving through space and a story moving forward, there's not really a lot happening. And it's just a really long explanatory bit of like how things work in this universe. But I personally am so into that. And those were like throughout both of these books, all of my favorite sections were the really interesting world building of how they interact with each other, how they create in culture, how they communicate, mm-hmm. the first encounter with humans, of course.
I'll add, I am the opposite in the sense that like I do not love world building. That is not my favorite mm-hmm. activity most of the time. And I would argue that Hadrian is one of, if not the best world building writers I've ever read, in the sense mm-hmm. that like it doesn't feel like that, you know, it just feels like unbelievably cool set pieces that also happen to convey so much detail about the world around them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, over the course of thousands of years, I think they say at some point the time span that the first book covers is roughly 2000 years. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah, that sounds about right in terms of you got the round trip for the ship and all the processes. Yeah.
And so as we see the rise of the spider civilization, we also in some ways chronicle the downfall of what we would recognize as human civilization and the wars and the cataclysms and the like slight rebuilding and then second downfall of human society and then them doing the Hail Mary and sending these arcs out into space to try to, you know, save mm-hmm. the last vestiges of humanity in these cryo ships that's a whole interesting thing. 'Cause I just always end up thinking about, how would I feel in that situation? Like I wake up and all of a sudden, like, I mean, I would be thrown off if like, you know, for example, like, you know, like I get into a car accident or something like that. And I wake up and somebody's like, oh yeah, like you've been unconscious for 4 days. Right.
Yeah.
I'd be like, oh man, that's like super destabilizing and very weird. And they're like, oh yeah, it's been like 1,000 years and you get to be awake for like 4 hours and then we're going to put you away again. Just like how unmoored from reality you would feel. And
yeah.
So, you know, I do find those things interesting, but I found it like I had to put so much extra effort into paying attention to those parts of the book because I'm just like, I want to know what the spiders are doing. And I'm not even necessarily horny for spiders in the way that you are, Aaron, but it is still very interesting to me because that's, the thing that initially, the hook that initially got me into this, the YouTube video that I saw was talking about the difficulties in communication between sentient beings who not only conceptualize the universe in a very different way, but also interact with the universe in a different way. And the problem of, you know, how do you even recognize that this thing is trying to communicate concepts to you in a way that you would understand, let alone tell stories. And
right.
Gosh, yeah, it's so big. There's so much.
Yeah. And with that one, you know, I feel like the first one to me is really about empathy. And we're going to talk about sort of like gaps between people and things. But like the first one is sort of like bridging the gap between like monster and person where, you know, it turns out we're obviously the monsters, the portents are the heroes.
Right.
And they save us with their empathy. Mm-hmm. But like this one, I feel like really takes the question of different kinds of minds and their different ways of engaging with the world and the different kinds of communication that would come out of that and really just cranks that button, rips off the knob. So, you know, I'm excited about that part. And I guess we should maybe introduce sort of a bit of what's going on in the new one. Cause like, yeah, I guess we can say at the end of the first one, just to sort of wrap up how that conflict goes, right? It's the final confrontation between the remaining humans. And instead of the spiders murdering them all, which they could have easily done,
right,
you know, they choose, they actually disagree with Kern, who obviously clearly wanted them to murder all the humans because humans,
right,
and instead save them with their empathy drug. And they're able to bridge that gap enough, right? They don't have to kill each other. And so the ending is kind of this semi-stable piece in the beginning of our first interspecies society, essentially.
Yeah, and I think I would have been bummed if it ended there because I didn't initially realize that there were sequels until you said like, oh yeah, the second book's really good too, and like we could do an episode about that, because I was just immediately like, of course, you know, it is interesting to see like once they actually recognize intelligence in the other and decide to interact and decide to communicate and they, you know, they end up coming to that understanding. I'm just like, oh my God, I need to know more about how these folks get on. Like, what does that look like? Because arachnophobia is not a thing for me, but I also, there is a bit of instinctive, like,
right.
Through all of these stories, I always just think about like, okay, let me try to imagine actually living in this world. And
right.
If I saw a spider that is like comparatively sized to a human, I can promise you I would be terrified of it initially.
Yeah, and I think they're supposed to be like slightly bigger, like really large dogs or something like that at the end of the day or something. But like for sure, you know, anyone, no matter how not arachnophobic, like you're talking about a nightmare world. Like for sure a top 10 nightmare world.
Yeah.
And they just like live in the trees.
Yeah. And especially as they're, you know, as they're approaching the planet and you get that description of the like the space station type things that the spiders have built.
So good.
Such a good job of painting that mental image. And I was just like, it felt very like evolutionarily gross, like not gross in a way that culture has programmed me to be, but one of those fears that feels like it really does come from the depths of like evolutionary memory.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's actually truly that way, but that's what it felt like to me.
No, it's true. He simultaneously manages to create a species that I find deeply interesting, let's say, and what desire to engage with, but also recognize would be absolute nightmare fuel if you were to really take seriously what they are like in the real world, especially because they're not like nice, right? Like they have an empathy drug and that's their solution, but like it's barely holding back their desire to be some really vicious hierarchical monsters.
Right. And I guess, you know, maybe begin wrapping up plot and of the first one anyways, and kind of introduce the first bit of the second one.
Yeah.
A thing that I struggled with a fair bit is that so much of the culture that the spiders ended up developing felt familiar to me in a way that almost didn't feel realistic. Like it felt like they replicated a lot of foibles that we would recognize as human, but I feel pretty strongly are like a cultural inheritance and not a species inheritance that I don't know would necessarily have. And I found myself wishing for them to be a little bit more alien,
a little weirder.
in their like thinking and their philosophy, because of course the mechanics of how they interact with the world are deeply alien, and the vibrating their palps and all
of
that sort
of
stuff.
Fire and you have, have metal and all that stuff. Like, what do you feel like? Were there specific examples where you were like, "This is a little too human-y for me"?
The gender politics.
It was
a specific
kind of
thing
inversion.
For me. Yeah, because it felt very much like the gender politics that we have been dealing with as a culture for a very long time just flipped on its axis. And there's the bit where Fabian is kind of earning the respect of the females, and it feels very much like that's a thing that like women had to do to be accepted as scientists. They had like, we're just going to be calculators and let all of the scientists take the credit for that. And then we slowly gain the respect of the men in our culture. And that's how we get into that. And then like we, you know, slowly push forward like that. And it felt, it didn't feel good.
A little on the nose.
Yeah. But also I know that some of that culture was being driven by, on the palp. But also I know that like a fair amount of that was being driven by the Kern AI, who is coming from that same cultural background. And so it's like,
and I'm not sure they make that connection explicit, but at least implicitly, I feel like there's a kind of inherited misogyny or misandry, I guess would be the technical term.
Right. Yeah.
A little bit of reverse sexism.
Yeah. So so empathy drug. Empathy is the solution. They do a pretty on the palp prisoner's dilemma kind of thing, which I found very interesting, because normally, I guess in a situation like that, it almost feels like, this isn't a new, like you're literally doing the prisoner's dilemma. You didn't like try to reinvent it or anything like that, but it's still like, it felt so perfect still. And that the
it's a novel feeling answer, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It is the answer that like people don't think of as the more collaborative answer is actually, you know, the pro-social and actually the evolved answer, right? Like it should be the human answer.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love it. It's so good. It's a perfect book. Luckily, books 2 and 3 are also amazing. So,
And I am so glad that book 2 is the one that I'm going to spend the most of the time discussing with you, because
yeah, I'm glad, because I'm really excited because you've been sharing your feelings with me a little bit, and I'm very excited to watch you flail around while expressing yourself through spiky color.
I love Paul so much, my angsty tentacly boy.
Do you want to explain who Paul is to folks?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're still doing the plot thing, so okay. I guess let's
do some highlights.
Yeah, let's introduce book 2, and we find that in the sense of, you know, the first book covers thousands of years of time. The second book doesn't pick up like the second the first book ends, but it feels like it starts relatively soon after the first book ends, but long enough that there's a sort of peace and understanding between spiders and humans for the most part. We get a little bit of background of how, there are humans who live on the spider planet, and there's like a human reservation for the humans that are just like, I'm sorry, we're never going to feel comfortable living with spiders. So there's a reservation and they're like off doing their own thing. And the spiders have collectively decided like, cool, you guys get that. We'll just never go there.
Which is respectable.
It is. I don't love that it's a thing, but I understand why it's a thing. And I'm glad that they gave the consideration to that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this one's going to be great for the like human spider politics, in terms of the like, you know, the power dynamic is that spiders are the dominant species both on the planet. And you get the sort of sense in the social interactions, broadly speaking, they're kind of top spider. And then like, yeah, the humans are trying to like play catch up almost, it feels like, in terms of, you know, having to like be the ones like with the responsibility of code switching, in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's, I love sci-fi universes that work things out that way, and that like, no, humans actually aren't at the top of the hierarchy there. It's one of the things that I love about Mass Effect, is that like there's all kinds of stuff going on in the universe, and it's like, yeah, oh, the humans are here too, by the way.
Right.
It's a little bit of an ego check for humanity. And So the remind me the like full on inciting incident of how the story actually begins.
So this one is very non sequential in that it has a present day and a past story happening.
Yeah.
So there's like a whole series of events that's somewhat contemporaneous with the timing in the first book, which is humans. A group of humans like Kern's team get to another system that was potentially habitable, find two planets that might be decent options, and hijinks ensue.
Hijinks ensue.
And then there's a present day story, which is, I think, sort of foretold, right? Like previewed a little bit in the first one, which is like a ship of humans plus spiders is exploring that system because they got a signal from that system or something like that.
Right. They do a very interesting description of how they're like, spiders and humans have sort of figured out how to communicate with each other, but imperfectly. And there's like, you know, the spiders are like vibrating their legs and the humans in their suits have these implants that will try to interpret what's being said. And so that's interesting. I love that they didn't quite hand wave away the like, oh, everybody understands each other now. So like there's no more plot to be held there. Like, I love that. I love that Adrian didn't decide to make that a thing. I was going to move along to the next plot point. So if you had something else to say.
Well, I was going to talk about the sort of the one group of characters, right? The Kern ship, which is definitely one of my highlights, partly because of just the design of the ship, I think, is pretty original. So like they use the ported technology of a ship, made of web, essentially, where the ship can grow as it needs to in all sorts of cool ways and is still running on the ant technology. So it's a complicated, weird, differentiated system, and it's running its core processor is running a Kern program, but then you have this like crew who, like you said, are sort of research explorers really more than anything else, right? And a lot of them are like everybody in these worlds, like interested in their own weird little projects. So, and they have like these different weird little projects, a lot of which are like different versions of trying to figure out bridging that communication gap in different ways. And I think that's particularly cool that like there isn't just like we invented this one, babblefish technology in order to solve the problem. It's like, well, no, these scientists want to do this thing and these scientists think that's garbage and they're trying this thing over here.
Yeah. And sort of parallel to that, or around that time, we get introduced to our friend who is working with octopuses. And I am deliriously excited at this point in the story because I'm like, is that going to be the thing for, like, are we getting sentient octopuses? Because I appreciate the existence of spiders in nature. And like I said, I don't have a visceral fear or hatred. I appreciate them as like fellow occupants of the earth, but they don't excite me. Octopuses, however, I have such love for those tentacly little creatures. And they're like very high on my list of like not domesticated animals that if I could snap my fingers and become friends with, like they would be very high on my list of species that I would make that happen with. And I don't think the book outright says it, but they do mention that, is it Dizra Sinkevi? He's the octopus guy,
I think,
right?
Desi is the way I try to remember him.
They kind of hint that like he's not outright like, I'm uplifting octopuses and we're going to do the thing. But he's like sort of experimenting with doing a little bit of uplifting here and there. And I was, I was waiting for that to go wrong and for the octopuses to just.
And if you know anything about octopuses, you can know immediately how wrong this is going to go. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't happen quite as suddenly as all of that, but that is kind of what happens. And, we get introduced to the main octopus character ends up being. And the octopuses, like the spiders, there are different generations that we use the same name for. That. Right. So there's, Paul 1 through Paul, however many numbers. And Paul is our anxious, angsty, emotional boy that we get throughout So
yeah, and we'll talk about their consciousness here in a second. It's certainly true that, you know, somebody told me that I was going to love this book even more than the first one because they understood that, like, you know, if anyone was going to guess what thing I would inappropriately uplift, it would certainly have been something octopi related. I actually, the first time through this book, didn't get into it quite as much. I think partly it was just because the first book hit me so hard. Mm-hmm. And this one has a lot of really good stuff in it. But yeah, the second time through, though, I really did strongly identify a lot more with Desi, which I think is a bad sign psychologically for me. But like, I loved the way that he was sort of, you know, he clearly just actually preferred the octopi and wanted to uplift them, but he was sort of justifying it on the grounds of they'll be useful workers and they can help us, you know, because one of the two planets they found when they got to the system was all water, like, you know, 95% water. So they're like, well, why not? And, you know, he's already got a thing with them and stuff, and they're good at understanding virtual environments and things like that. So, yeah, that was obviously, you know, a match made in weird tentacle heaven for me. But we get even more than that, right? Because we also get the Land of Nod.
Yeah. Which that was an interesting thing, because if I'm remembering the timing of the plot of the book, right, they start really hinting at sentient octopuses. And then we get the first chapter where I consumed the book in audio format, which is, I feel like, I mean, audiobooks just make sense for the way that my brain likes to process information, but also the narrator of the first book and this book does a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. And it's the first chapter where we start getting the these of we, et cetera, et cetera.
The we.
It's an interesting thing, because the way that it put together for me is I thought we were in the head of the octopi. I didn't realize that we were in the head of something completely different.
Which is interesting. That didn't occur to me the first time I read through. But when you said it, I could totally see how that bait and switch. And, like, you know, he likes those kind of bait and switch sometimes. Right. So I think you're right, that is deliberate probably, especially because of the way that we get sort of the description of octopi consciousness. And, you know, we can talk maybe a little bit about that, but I think we'll save sort of the big discussion of different kinds of weird consciousness for the second one, and just sort of highlight this opening sort of discussion of the problem of communication, because we also, the last bit of like action-y stuff in the first part is back in the present, where our, you know, spider ship shows up and they, you know, get greeted by some other ships and they're not entirely clear what's going on. And it's a very, very, like, sort of weird combat situation. What was your sort of experience of that first fight?
I was actually kind of upset, because it was like they do the, like, these ships are meeting. What's going to happen? And there's this big buildup, and then all of a sudden the story goes back in time, and it's like three chapters before you get back to the actual battle and you find out what's happening. That was my experience of it.
Right. They want you to have that experience of being in the little cryostasis for 1,000 years, right? You got to feel disjointed from waking up at all these weird times and stuff.
Right. Yeah. So thanks, Adrian, you jerk.
Yeah. So any other big highlights you feel like from this first little part that you really loved?
Maybe this gets more into the discussion about consciousness, but I love so much that as a person who, like, I'm not a gamer specifically, I'm a VR gamer. I loved so much that so much of that interaction happened in what is essentially this universe's version of VR, that he was trying to teach the octopodes how to do things in VR, and instead of giving them instructions, he figures out how to give them problems to solve and lets them solve their own problems. And that I fell in love so fast.
I guess we can talk a little bit about, like, you know, we get in that first part when he's uplifting them and teaching them the puzzles and stuff. Mm-hmm. We do find, you know, like, so there's a series of events that's probably worth laying out. He gets left at the water planet Desi, the leader and the other people mostly go to the other planet to see if it's a more habitable planet, essentially. But what they find out is life there. And they quickly find, like, organisms. And so they have to figure out, are we going to wipe out all these organisms and terraform it or what? And it's either going to do some research. And then you get an unfortunate confluence of events, which goes, I think basically the sequence of events is the octopi get smart enough that they start trying to take apart the ship's programs to see if there's a fish inside of it to eat. yes. So Desi has to take the rest of the people at Waterworld and send them down to the planet while he reboots the system to try to save the octopi.
And I just imagine the funny music playing in the background. Where he's like, "Oh, you know, it's just a thing. It's gonna be fine.
It's fine.
Yeah. It's gonna be fine. Don't worry about it."
It's such a funny image to imagine them sort of crawling through virtual space, like cracking open the technology. But you know, that would have been fine if it wasn't also for the fact the folks on Nod are just at that time going to take their ship down to the planet. And at the same time, this is when, from the first book, the virus hits the solar system. So there's this virus that was sent from Earth that corrupts all technology, expanding out into the universe, and it hits this solar system right at this unfortunate moment. Screws up the ship, the shuttle, killing everybody involved, except so Desi's the only one left on the blue planet, and then they're basically trapped for a bit of time on Nod as well. Is that pretty much how you read that?
Yeah, and it's the timing is convenient because the octopuses had damaged the ship just enough that it wasn't functional when the virus hit.
Or they get he'd done the hard reboot or something, yeah. Right as the virus hit. So yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that ship is like one of the few things
very
that survived.
Lucky. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Totally. And so he's able to like save the people from Nod, but not the other people. And
right.
But yeah, that's a great moment that starts funny and gets very very dark.
right. Yeah.
But is useful for tying sort of the timing of the events together. We have this event that sort of connects the two worlds in that way. So yeah, I think that's pretty much all the things, right?
Yeah, that's where I'm at. So
let's talk some philosophy. So I guess we should rock it.
It's a story device, literally. A literal literary device, quite literally, metaphorically containing us.
So the previous topics we covered when we did the first three books, and I want to mention them because Adrian, you know, leaves nothing behind on these kind of books. You know, we covered the ethics of uplifting, obviously, whether it's okay to take a species and uplift it in the way that people are doing in these books. We have sort of the second book, we talked about neuromorphic AI, which is going to show up again in this book as well, which is to say an AI that isn't built from the ground up as a artificial intelligence, but is instead a weird, you know, conscious biological upload hybrid of some sort. We get a couple of weird versions of those, including our friend the Kern ship. And this one continues to be our best neuromorphic AI. But we also, you know, we can talk about the neuromorphic stuff with relation to the language communication systems that are coming into use in this one. And then, as you mentioned in the first part, you know, we talked about the sort of prisoner's dilemma and the empathy solution to the prisoner's dilemma, which I think, you know, carries us over in a really beautiful way into sort of the back and forth of this book, right? If we wanted to be fancy about it, we could say the dialectic of this particular book, which is, I think, sort of a back and forth between a couple of ideas around separateness, basically. And, you know, the first book is arguably about separateness, too, right? You're trying to bridge this divide through empathy. But this book is about even a broader, I feel like, kind of sense of the problem of separateness. And I struggled to find an exact term for what this is to cover all the things I'm thinking of here, you know, like the communication gaps, all that kind of stuff. And then it popped into my mind that, like, what we absolutely should talk about is one of the, you know, the tent poles of talking about consciousness and separateness and communication, which is one we've referenced before, but is always worth coming back to as like a return to the basic stuff, which is a piece by Thomas Nagel called what it's like to be a bat. But obviously, in your case, we will, you know, amend it to what it's like to be a Paul.
Of course.
So, you know, how do we know what it's like to be a Paul is a very sort of deep, complicated question. And it's a question that arises as part of this sort of broader issue of this reality of separateness, right? It seems like we have an experience of being separate. And, you know, a lot of folks would argue that's bad.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I think it's also interesting to me to think about, you know, we think of like a collective consciousness in the way that is explored in this as being something that is wholly separate from the way that we experience the world. And mm-hmm. The more I think about it, the more I think we maybe are not as fundamentally different there as I think a lot of people are. I think if we didn't have the ability to communicate with each other, maybe, but we do end up, like, as we communicate with each other, we end up creating something that is a little more than any of us are individually. And I think that's just a description of what culture is and what society is. Mm-hmm. And I feel like in a basic way that the fundamental difference is not that, like, we experience those things differently. It's that the mechanisms those entities have are, like, more supercharged than the ones that we have. Like, they're more directly connected to one another and are able to more directly and effectively communicate, like, where they're at to add another individual's understandings to their own that then brings sort of uplifts mm-hmm. everyone the uplift, like, evolutionary sense, but uplift as in, like, my understanding of the world is now more because of combining it with yours.
Yeah, like social embodied cognition, I think, is one of the ways we could talk about this kind of idea. And definitely, I think, I think what we're going to do is, in part two, we're going to talk about the different kinds of distributed cognition, because I think this book does an amazing job of laying out all these different versions of kind of what you're highlighting, which is, you know, we struggle to imagine much diversity of the way that consciousness works, mm-hmm. right? We have our experience of this kind of first person perspective thing that we're doing, and it's hard to imagine it being anything different than that. If folks are interested in some other stuff we did about this, the book Blindsight is also very much about distributed cognition, but I would argue doesn't go nearly as far as this one in terms of imagining different versions, right? Different very weird versions. You know, often I think what you see with that kind of stuff is, like, it's a human perspective, but it's extended over technology or something, like you're part in the computer or something like that. But before we even get to that stuff, I want to get really broad and really weird about this.
let's get it.
You know, and I just want to talk about the nature of suffering as being the result of separateness, which mm-hmm. is, I think, an underlying philosophy that is central to all of the children, the series, essentially, that, like, you know, both the separate, you know, like, even from the very beginning of the first book, with Kern's sort of hatred of humans and a desire to be separate from them, there really is this feeling of, like, I don't understand you and I don't want to be in contact with you in this kind of way. And that leads to, you know, all of our unhappiness, all of our violence and things like that. This is something that I think, like, people are often very, like, intuitively aware of, and you see it, like, in a lot of different kinds of narratives. One that comes to mind would be, like, the Tower of Babel in the Bible, right? Where it's, like, the curse of separateness or the gap between one and the other in this kind of way, the I-thou gap or something. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, often what you see in reaction to this kind of stuff, especially nowadays with, like, mindfulness becoming sort of more popular and non-Western material seeping out into the world, is this kind of idea of non-dualism of some sort as a kind of solution to this. And that can mean, like, a lot of different things, and we can sort of ponder what that would even, like, similar to how we have a hard time understanding all the different kinds of distributed cognitions, we might have a hard time understanding what non-dual cognition is, given how much we're used to dualistic cognition, which, by which I just mean this this feeling of like I'm over here and you're over there and we're separate entities and there's a barrier in between us and stuff like that. And the world is made up of all these separate entities, right? So, you know.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a thing that I think about, because this is something that I apologize if it gets if it gets old. But the thing that I think about so much is how much we accept as a simple fact of our existence that is actually a product of cultural programming. And I mm-hmm. think this is the idea of separateness is like almost all of the ideas that we have been taught in our culture that are like, you have to have independence and you have to be independent. And that is having that is a sign of moral virtue. And depending on other people is a sign of like you have failed mm-hmm. in some way. And that always it serves to reinforce power. And despite that separateness almost always being terrible for us as a social species, so many of us are still convinced that like that is the ideal. And I mean, I'm experiencing that now as Celeste and I are splitting up. I live alone now. And you know, it's a thing that I think about a lot because it's like, we're not splitting up because we were miserable together. I still like her a lot. And so I just miss like having another person around all of the time. And of course this,
creatures.
Is like the turbocharged version of that. But yeah, that's that I've been thinking about that a lot actually.
Yeah, no, I do think that is really importantly connected at a cultural level, too, that, like, if you look at the studies of weirdness in the capital, you know, all the letters acronym sense of, like, Western highly individualist culture versus non-Western, quote-unquote, and again, these are very broad categories, but I think there is something to the idea that, like, there are at least different kinds of cultural approaches to the individual versus community spectrum, essentially, mm-hmm. and that, like, societies that lean more towards the community-ended kind of the spectrum have strengths and weaknesses, and the individualist one has strengths and weaknesses. And I think, you know, if you go too far in one direction or the other, things get particularly bad, which I think is what you're mm-hmm. describing.
Yeah.
That were, you know, I think a lot of us are experiencing that in the world today, and a lot of the crisis of meaning stuff that folks experience is a crisis of community, too much dualism, as it were, in that mm-hmm. sense. But, you know, when you start getting non-dualistic, you get a little communist, you know, like people start to get worried that like, and like, I think there's something reasonable to this, and this is what we'll see on the other side of the dialectic in this book, is that like, how do you resolve this problem without making everything boring, right? Because there's sort of a sense in which separateness is also the source of all, you know, like, to quote The Simpsons, it's both the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
Right.
So, like, I think about this a lot with the non-dualism stuff, because it's like, sure, I get in principle the idea of, like, you know, dualism is caused by attachment, right? My attachment to my sense of self and my beliefs. And if I meditate hard enough, I'll stop identifying with myself and I'll identify with you. And then we'll identify with each other. And then we'll be one entity or something like that. Mm-hmm. I get the vibe. But I also think that, like, life is the result of attachment to some extent, you know, like, and the Buddhists will talk about grasping without attachment, which I think it'd be fun to have a Buddhist analysis of the octopi, who I feel like are very graspy without attachment, you know, like yeah. they're very much a kind of in the moment sort of non-dualistic mm-hmm. creature. And you see the kind of strengths and weaknesses of that. And it's very similar to the kind of Taoist sages who get a bit silly when they yeah. get too non-dualistic, you know? They get,
yeah.
they get a bit weird.
I mean, this was the thing I was thinking about last night, because I was thinking about, I talked earlier about how it, like, it bums me out how familiar the spiders feel. Like, I would love for them to feel less familiar to me. Mm-hmm. But also, one of the reasons that I love the octopuses is because they feel so deeply familiar to me. But I also think about, like, the reason why they feel so familiar to me is also the same reason why I feel so alien in, like, broader society. So, like, maybe that's not necessarily a contradiction. But.
Nope. I think probably all those things tie together yeah. pretty well. I think what you're saying is you're excited that we've done chapter one and now we're moving on to the, you know, expanding out the concept a little bit.
Yeah.
And yeah, so you know, I think it's reasonable for us to ask, like, what is this, like, experience of non-dualism that we're trying to get to that is the cure of this separateness and sufferingness and stuff like that? And it, maybe it ties to this sort of point that we've been chatting about, that, like, we have limits on how much we can really conceive of anything beyond our own experiences. But I think one reasonable interpretation that some might have is that we all become part of one first-person subjective experience, right? We all just become one consciousness experiencing itself in a reflective and, kind of way or something,
and resistance,
right?
Like, is futile and
right. All just one big hive mind, yeah. You know, coming together. And like that I think starts to pose the problems that we will pick up on in like the next second and third part. But I also think, you know, it's interesting to talk at the beginning here about just like the practicalities. Is that really a possible thing? And I was thinking about it in terms of one of the big problems of separateness that comes up in this kind of literature, which is the problem of, you know, to put it in the most cliche stoner sense, like, how do I know what, you know, if the color red that you see is the same as the color red that I see?
Right.
You know, fancy term for this, it looks like a problem of reference. Like, we, mm-hmm. you know, the separateness problem isn't just bad because I want to be in your brain because that would be cool. It's that I want to understand you. You know, mm-hmm. connection is made through understanding. And there is always going to be this space where we hope that language is bridging that gap. We desperately hope it is, but like, we don't know, you know? And even if we feel like we know, there's probably going to be little bits that are different that we would never be able to think to ask and understand the differences between them. So like, how would you actually bring about this idea of, you know, like a shared first person perspective in this kind of way?
Yeah, this is a thing that I struggle with, because I think the answer to that question, I think, would solve probably most of the worst societal ills that we have. because I think fundamentally, so much of the problem is not even necessarily that we have a difficulty understanding each other. It's that we don't want to, and that we don't care to understand each other. Mm. And the idea that, like, doing that is not only unnecessary, but is actually a failing and is somehow threatening. And
you can't screw them over in the prisoner's dilemma.
Right. Yeah. And I think in one way it's really a thing of values, because, for example, I was at a friend's house last night hanging out with them. And this is a friend who experiences visual art and color and visual things the same, like, deeply visceral way that I experience auditory experiences. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, like, we have a pretty fundamentally different experience of the world in one really important way, in that, like, that person is going to look at a piece of visual art and see depth there that it's not that I don't think I'm capable of seeing. It's just that, like, I've not learned how to tune my attention in the way that they have towards the thing that is their thing. Mm-hmm. But there is something recognizable in that experience, in that, like, I know what it's like to fixate on those sorts of small details about a thing. And it's like, you're doing about a thing that you see, and I'm doing it about a thing that I hear. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason why that difference isn't a problem is because we both have a shared value of at least understanding how someone else moves through the world, and knowing that, like, we don't actually have to share that to connect and for there to be value in that. We just need to be interested in that and care about that and value that. And mm-hmm. I think fundamentally what I'm trying to figure out, like, if changing someone's mind is even possible. I feel like there are lots of people who understand that this is, like, it's a valuable thing to understand what other people are going through, and maybe they just don't have the tools to do it yet. And so they're, like, fumbling through it awkwardly and maybe being not so great in the process, but they're, like, really trying because foundationally they're in the right place and they just need to be, like, right, guided on that journey, versus the kind of person who, like, really truly just does not seem to be interested in that at all. Like, you know, mm-hmm. you're a trans person, so you're fundamentally disgusting to me, and I have no interest in understanding where you're coming from, why you're coming from the way that you are, because what you are is so fundamentally opposed to everything that I stand for. I don't know how to cut through that.
Right. Yeah. And I like the way that you highlighted that, like, what the added dimension that I think we're really getting here is seeing this idea of, like, if you have entities that, you know, technically have the same senses, but, like, are using them to vastly different degrees and in vastly different ways, what is the consciousness? What is the communication that emerges out of that? So to drill back down on some examples from the story, you know, like I mentioned, we have a couple different versions of the trying to communicate between the spiders and the humans, mm-hmm. right? We have a communication via the Kern ship, which can translate between them. And one of the funniest bits that you and I both loved and chatted about is, you know, when the Kern ship is using a bunch of its processing power in the fight, for example, it can't communicate subtle nuances quite as effectively. So it gets blunter and more snarky, essentially, as it has to move more, energy around, more ants around, as it were.
Yeah.
We have that version, and then we have the glove thing that they're working on, where it's like the point of the glove, because the spiders are so much more touch based than humans, mm-hmm. that it allows human touch to catch up in a sense, right? And you can be kind of sensitive to all of the details of the little foot waggling and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But then you have this connection, direct connection thing that I think Mish is the shorthand they use for him, right? The one who's working with the male spider to create essentially a sensory bridge, I think would be the way to think about it, right? Yeah. Like a direct virtual uplink, essentially, where you could basically, and the goal here is to understand the world as the spider, because as we said, power wise you know, spiders don't really care much about understanding the world as humans, but the humans want to, you know, understand the world as spiders because there's a lot of spiders around. And there's a lot of really interesting, flashbacky stuff about the characters being motivated to do this stuff because of their relatives on the reservation who can't connect to one of the cool things about the reservation, or horrifying, having to think about it, it's partly for people for whom the empathy virus didn't take. I think they mentioned at one point.
Yeah.
So you're it's not just that they don't want to be around spiders, it's that it didn't work on them. So they are just like normal humans engaging. And they even do a thing in the book, which may not have been clear in the audiobook version. He capitalizes humans in relation to post-empathy virus humans and contrasts them with pre-empathy virus humans.
Yeah, it does capitalize, this person was not a capital H human. It was just a human.
Okay, yeah. So I think that's a really interesting distinction, essentially, that they're treated as different species because of the genetic augmentation, which, not totally implausible. Mm-hmm. But we have this Mish approach, which is going to be the kind of technology that you would imagine you would need if you really wanted to bridge the divide, not just, manage a rough overlap via language, right? But then I think there's a reasonable question that especially this book is going to put forward, which is, have you really actually bridged the consciousness of two separate organic beings via a virtual connection? Or have you created a new entity that's part virtual, part to the two entities as inputs, and is its own consciousness, and it's outputting back into the other two entities information processed via that weird system.
Right. And that's, I don't know that I have a strong sense of that. And I think probably an important thing to name, because I think this is really important, is that the notion that spiders have understandings, that it's mm-hmm. is a different thing than what we think of as knowledge. And I think they actually say it at one point in the second book, where they essentially say that the spiders communicate in memes, basically.
Right.
Like
uploadable memes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it's the, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain it. Changing mm-hmm. around the idea that I, instead of handing you a picture of the troublemaker, the smiling child in front of the house, right? I can hand you that picture. And if you have no idea what the cultural context is, you're just this is just a picture of a child smiling in front of a burning building. And maybe I have a sense of what that means. But mm-hmm. If you've been on the internet for a certain period of time, that picture actually means a whole lot more than that. And the spiders essentially transmit culture in that way. They transmit these large cultural understandings from generation to generation. And that's I would argue probably the most significant thing that the Uplift virus has given them. And I feel like that was what you were talking about with that link up is like almost trying to give the humans an analog of that and trying to help them learn to communicate up. And So
yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I think the understandings to me are kind of like a step up above cultural transference, right? If you think about the approaches to uplifting, which is actually arguably just evolution with, you know, a little bit more planning, right. You know, are going to be biological and then cultural, and cultural is going to move much faster. And the understandings are like a supercharged version of culture. Instead of the human approach where I have to watch you do the thing and then mimic that behavior, they just literally kind of pass it on genetically in this way. So yeah, you can see why that would give them kind of an advantage, temporally, in terms of they could, you know, and it makes, it's a cool solution also, I think, to having a species that, it develops advanced technology without living as long, because realistically, there's not a lot of advantage to having a bunch of understandings if you die young and you take most of your life to learn those understandings. So you need that really hyper fast transference for the spiders to be, you know, sort of functional as entities. But, you know, the point of memes, I think, is really valuable, because what we have to ask ourselves often when you're doing this bridging of the separateness is, you know, what degree of fidelity do we want? Right.
Right.
Rarely am I trying to necessarily have a perfect picture of the image inside of your head. Sometimes, right, like an artist is trying to really perfectly capture in a description an exact moment or something like that. You know, but a lot of times even there, they're sort of selectively highlighting foregrounds and backgrounds and things like that. And then you think about like the different technologies that I just mentioned, you know, the glove versus Kern versus the brain thing. You know, each of them is making sort of cost benefit trade-offs in terms of functionality versus fidelity, essentially. Like the glove doesn't capture nearly as much, but I don't have to hardwire a spider into my brain, which, as we find out over the course of this book, is not necessarily a great idea, especially with a Kern hanging around. So yeah, you know, I think we can, at the end of the day, sort of ask ourselves, which of these things would we actually really want? Do we really want the kind of direct person-to-person communication that the machine would provide, or would we actually be happier if we just had like slightly better gloves or something?
Yeah, and I feel like, I mean, that's the thing that comes up when you start talking about telepathy too. Like if you're just you grow up knowing what everyone is thinking all around you all the time, like, is that actually a good thing? And I mean, I like the idea of having it and having the ability to turn it on or off selectively.
and that's sort of, you know, not to jump at, you know, call forward too much, but like, I think that telepathy conversation is really central to like the flip side of this dialogue. But yeah, you're totally right that like at the end of the day, it gets to that kind of place where, you know, do you want the true connection, if that means utter lack of privacy or something like that, right? If it raises serious questions about autonomy, if you're like me, maybe that doesn't worry you quite so much. But, you know, some people might be sort of more concerned about that. But then you get this sort of added other layer that you mentioned earlier about, well, what if the sense organ is just different? We're going in a very different direction in terms of the balance of sense organs. You know, so for the octopi, what we're told is that like all of the information that's being transferred ship to ship is like 90% visual, I think that they say at one point. The implication is that like they're a purely sort of visual performance art kind of species, between their sort of skin colors and their dancing moves and things like that. And that's interesting to me, because technically humans are also a 90% visual species, in the sense that, like, as far as I understand it, we get like 90% of our information primarily through our visual cortex, unless that's been a debunked one like the brain thing, in which case don't at me, but tell me and I'll correct it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think percentage wise aside, I do think it is accurate to say that at a subconscious level, we take in a lot more from visual cues than we might consciously realize on average. You know, like, there are probably lots of folks who who do it less, some folks who do it more. But I think on average, there's a lot more of that happening than you might consciously realize. And that's, you know, I mean, fundamentally why like a Zoom call often feels different than a phone call. Or,
right.
You know, like if you're doing a podcast interview, sometimes it feels better to have your camera on, even if it's just for audio, for example.
I think what
makes the octopuses feel fundamentally different is that they have less of an ability to mask themselves in the ways that humans often do. In that, like, you know, whether or not it feels good for a human to do that, I think generally it's possible for us to learn to do that, to play like whatever social games we have to play to get by at work or to like get through times with family or whatever. But, and I think like a lot of the things that we feel and the ways that we react are involuntary, but we can choose to control some of the ways that those things get expressed versus if you're an octopus and you get upset, your skin changes color. And that's not really a thing that you have control over. So you don't have the ability to mask the way that you're feeling or hide the way that you're feeling. And in a culture where fewer individuals are just utterly incapable of masking themselves in that way, I can think of ways that I would love that, because that's one of the reasons that I so deeply identify with them, is that I find it more and more difficult as time goes on to play those games like that, to like when somebody says something that's really upsetting, it is almost physically painful for me to try to hide that if I feel like I need to. But like fundamentally, I know I have the capability, and for me doing it is a conscious choice of whether or not I do it. But for the octopuses, it is far less of a choice. Like they do mention at some point that like they can kind of learn to do things differently in that way. But like it's a lot more involuntary for them. And I can recognize how that might be a problem in some ways, but I also find it very appealing.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about the way that their consciousness is distributed some on the next episode, but like it is worth at least noting, broadly speaking, they are described as kind of a very id species, right? You know, they are a lot of impulse, and like you say, they're sort of wearing their octopi hearts on their sleeves, and
there actually is a line, they wear their hearts on their skins.
Did they say that at one point? Yeah.
Yes.
But it's, you know, so it's good. Also that their culture, I think they describe it at various points, is very sort of performance oriented. It's they like to tell stories or describe events or something to each other, and they do it in the form of these very complicated dances. And like to them, the peak of success is a well-orchestrated performance that conveys something meaningful in this way. So again, it is that kind of, the dream is the bridging of the communication gap in this way.
And sometimes physically fighting with each other. Like that's a very normal way that they communicate and work out ideas with each other.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's fascinating about the octopi to me, right? Because they are simultaneously like humans in that they take in vast amounts of information visually, but they're also like the spiders in that they take in vast amounts of information physically, tactilely. So they are a weird mix of the two, and what does that mean for their consciousness, especially given that like, you know, you sort of get the sense that like the visual part is one going to be one piece of their consciousness and the tactile another part. So they're a little bit like communicating. There's a thing in the book Anathem that you'll read one day eventually about this almost, that is a parable about the senses. How do the senses communicate with each other? How is it possible that like our brain can take physical information from our fingertips and, you know, auditory information and put those things together and create a concept in our head that is, you know, a proper representation of the universe, when they're, you know, they're providing different streams of information in a very fundamental kind of way. But I also just love that, like, just on the visual side of things, going back to your meme point, you know, they are staring at these like huge LED screens on the side of these ships at various points, trying to understand them. And they're like, you know, we get that they're like emoting at each other, but like we do not know a lot of what is going on here. And it's an interesting point that it doesn't have to be that two species use different organs, you know, or have super weird tentacle organs or something like that. You could just both have visual organs, but you have a totally different language of visual representation. you know, and then like, how do you bridge that weird gap?
Yeah, because again, they also, the octopus is to a different degree, but they do communicate somewhat mimetically, like not exactly the way that the spiders do, but more so than the humans do for sure. And mm-hmm. they find human communication kind of as alien. And they lay that out in really interesting ways. And again, it's like you see the humans like rolling this over. We'll probably talk about that a little more in the next episode when they actually meet and try to communicate with each other. It's another interesting way that those communication dynamics work out, that it's like, mm-hmm. like it's not even a matter of, I know that what I am looking at is communication and I just have to parse it out. Mm-hmm. It is having to figure out if what you're seeing is communication or not before you can start to parse out the words and the grammar and all of that. Like, is this right. an attempt to communicate? If it is, what is it? Because we're immediately thinking in terms of like, okay, we have to learn the words and we have to learn the grammar. But even assuming that that is the method of communication is assuming too much.
Right. You know, one other tentacle language episode that we did a while back was on Arrival, which is mm-hmm. about, you know, based on Ted Chiang's story. And like there, like the gap is partly perception of time, you know, yeah. whether you experience it linearly or not. But there's also that like a lot of work about trying to understand the sort of phonetics of grammar and things like that. But, you know, as we talked about in that episode, like there's an interesting question of with an octopi, does it have a grammar, right? Does it think about like words in that sense, or does it just sort of form gestalts and you just kind of order them as you prefer, like interpretively? It can be sort of very open-ended in that kind of way. And you get that kind of sense that it is a lot of this kind of emoting. I also like, you know, to dive a little into the cultural differences. I love that, you know, you have your humans and then you have your spiders who are like somewhat hierarchical, but a little bit more kind of community sort of oriented, and the octopi who are like simultaneously community oriented and anarchists, you know.
Yeah.
they're both, you know, well, let's put it this way. They're simultaneously a lot of things, because one of the things about their consciousness is that they are really switching around a lot, right? They're really mm-hmm. open-ended in a way that I would say, you know, some extent, sometimes the spiders feel even less so. And maybe it's because they're being infected by human slowness or something like that. But I think something, you know, as we discussed in the previous one, the human sections are the ones you're always trying to click away from. In this one, you know, the spiders and the humans, I guess maybe they average out their quality a little bit or something, but like the humans do, you like bring the spiders down a little bit relative to the octopi, it feels like, almost. And actually kind of this raises a question, you know, when we're assessing what level of connectedness we want, you know, it's not just a question of things like privacy. I think it's also a question of, is there something fundamentally lost if I have a species that evolves one kind of consciousness based on one kind of phenomenal experiences, and then I give it a full direct access to another kind of phenomenal experiences? Do I essentially end up blending, like sort of the way like cultural mixing is good, but there's also a kind of value in having these separate experiences because they can give us a very unique separate perspective on the world. Is it a concern that the, you know, the humans end up converging with the spider consciousness and the spider way of seeing the world in a way that is less adaptive than if they kept their minds separate in that sense?
Yeah. And I mean, to bring it back to human relationships, I think about that often in, you know, balancing, you know, maybe there is someone that I want to have some level of relationship to, but maybe there is like, there's enough value in that relationship that I am okay being a little bit less fundamentally myself. And there's like, there's an inverse correlation between like the more deeply I want this relationship, the more I might be willing to sacrifice that thing. That's not to say that this is a healthy motivation, to be clear, mm-hmm. but it's a thing that I often end up thinking about, especially, you know, because thinking about human relationships in terms of not having like a romantic relationship, for example, as a polyamorous person, I am not necessarily getting into a relationship with the idea that the correct way to do a relationship is this ever escalating entanglement of your lives with one another, such mm-hmm. that in order for the relationship to work at all, you have to be able to be fundamentally comfortable with everything about who that person is, or it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I'm having a more casual relationship with someone, there might be a piece of myself that I don't bring into that because I can do that in other places, right? Like if I have someone who like head over heels in love with this person, but they just cannot stand Star Trek, I might be able to turn that sort of side of myself. Like despite Star Trek being a really important thing to me, I might be able to bring less mm-hmm. of that to my relationship with this person because I get so much of that out of that, right? Mm-hmm. And there's that, the balancing act of I can make broader connections with a larger variety of people if I suppress certain parts of myself, but I do fundamentally lose something if I do more of that. And right. there's the idea of like, I'm giving up something that's maybe special about me, but also is the fact that there is something special about me, is that like a cultural narcissism that I need to learn to unpack, that like you're not actually that special of a snowflake. Like, yes, you're an individual, you deserve autonomy and rights and all of that sort of stuff. But like, is that a fundamentally healthy thing to want? Mm-hmm. And I think like most things, there is a degree to which the answer is yes and a degree to which the answer is no.
Yeah. But I can just piggyback a little bit.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
No, just like, it's interesting that you brought this up. There was a recent Ezra Klein episode with Dan Savage. And one thing that stuck out to me in that conversation that I thought was very interesting was their discussion about privacy, where like Savage had a very sort of critical view of people's inability to like let their partners have privacy, which was an interesting thought that like hadn't, you know, it wasn't something that was like explicit in my mind, I guess, in a sense. But it is a really interesting question of like, what is the reasonable, you know, amount of privacy to expect in a relationship is an important question that should be navigated. And it probably is the case that for a lot of people, the default is, you know, you wouldn't have any privacy, or you'd expect full transparency in some kind of way with your partner. But like coming back to this idea of separate consciousnesses, right, I do think there's something to wanting privacy in a variety of kinds of ways in a relationship that I think can be valuable, but it's not at all clear to me like where the right line is to draw in a question like that. And it's probably something that like you navigate in your relationship over the course of things. But like, you know, I know you love the octopi. Trying to imagine living in Octopolis with, you know, like everybody crawling over each other. There's right. no privacy. Like, and like right. consciousness wise, there's no privacy, right? They're all mm-hmm. so expressive. All like it would be an entire society of extroverts. And I, as an introvert, immediately mm-hmm. recoil, you know, somewhat from that concept. Yeah. I do think there's something, you know, like to the idea of the goodness of the separateness sometimes that like maybe mm-hmm. the octopi could potentially lose or something like that.
Yeah. Well, in this, I also understand that my reaction to that is a reaction to the outsized pressure that I feel to be something I'm fundamentally not in the world I actually live in. Because, I mean, you're right. Even
a
like
four appendage creature.
Right. Like, you know, if I actually lived in that world, there absolutely there are several ways that I can think that I would immediately become very uncomfortable. But it's because it's a visceral reaction to the unhealthy level of pressure that I feel to like, you know, you this is a time when it's appropriate to emote. This is a time when it is not appropriate to do so. And even in the appropriate times, you have to be really careful about how you go about it, how big your feelings are. And, it's always couched in, because you are the person who is slightly different from the rest, the goal is for you to make yourself smaller to accommodate the discomfort of the people in power and the people who are like normal or typical or whatever. You know, in a world where that sort of openness and that sort of like, you're going to know everything I'm thinking all at once, in a world where that is the norm and that is the pressure realistically, there are lots of things I'd be uncomfortable about with that too.
Yeah, though, like, it's interesting to think about what you've all the stuff that you've been suggesting brings me back to Desi, right? This genius misanthrope, right? Like so many of our uplifting geniuses. Right. But like, it's fascinating that as someone like that would particularly want to uplift a species that was so aggressively extroverted in this kind of way, you mm-hmm. know, in a sense that, like, if he's allowed to be in that space with those entities, he comes out of his shell, right? They pry him out of his shell, right? And they get the sweet meats inside.
Yep, yep.
But, like, he, you know, is comfortable with connecting to them in a way that he isn't with the humans. And I think there's something interesting that, like, the level of connectedness you want to have with another entity is going to relate partly to that particular entity. Like, there are some times where I would much rather interact with someone via the glove than, like, via the direct sensory interface. Yeah. It might not just be a, like, all, you know, one size fits all communication device, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you want to have the camera off while you're on Zoom.
Right. Yes, absolutely.
You know? I like that. What you're seeing in these stories, not to psychoanalyze Adrian too much, but, like, you know, it's about misfit toys, a lot of these books, right? It's about outcasts who connect to other outcasts via, you know, weird processes of various sorts.
And I think, you know, the question of motivations is an interesting one, because I think in the first book they make it very clear that Kern's primary motivation seems to be that she wants to become a god.
There's a lot of narcissism there. Yep, for sure.
But I feel like I don't know that I have as clear an idea of what Sinkevi's motivations were with the octopuses. Mm. Like, mm-hmm. is it really that he is just like, well, this is interesting to me and this is an interesting thing to try to engage with, so I'm going to do that as an intellectual exercise, as a knowledge seeking exercise, as a way to communicate with creatures that I feel a kinship with that I don't with other humans. It's an interesting thing to think about and motivations like that. Because I don't even know that a primary motivation for him is connecting with them. Although, I mean, there's obviously some of that in there, and whether or not it was a primary motivation, he certainly gets there.
Well, when you ask the question, my first thought that comes to mind is, well, he's like an octopi, so let's answer the question from an octopi perspective, right? And from the octopi perspective, he doesn't have a motivation, right? It's not like a human being where you create a plan and then you enact that plan exactly. It's more, I think what we would say is that somewhere deep in his, you know, squishy parts, he knew that he really wanted to just let the octopi take over that planet. You know, like that was the world he wanted, was Octopolis for sure. Yeah. Not in a conscious way, though. It was just that his limbs did the thing, right? They just kind of reached out and fulfilled the goal in this sense. You could say, look, did he want the octopi to end up taking over that planet? In the sense that he wanted things, yes. In the sense that his species wants things, yes.
Right, yeah.
And I sympathize, but, you know, like I love that idea. I also wonder, like, is there sort of a goal of putting something in that will compete with humans potentially? You know, like, he recognizes that at some point humans will pose a threat to these entities. And I kind of get the sense at some points that it's not just I want to create this octopolis, it's that I want to make it functional enough that it will survive human contact. And I love, I don't want to run out of time here, talking about consciousness and culture again, like, I like that the octopolis, you know, the just like with the spiders, Adrian really takes seriously the constraints of what a species like this could actually accomplish and writes a plausible narrative for how they are spacefaring. There's no plausible narrative that easily comes to mind where a id-driven species like this that can't organize, even if they're hyper, super duper creative, right?
Yeah.
And are also water-based, are not getting off a planet, right? But because he allows for the setting up of, like, the space ring before all the, everything goes sideways, you know, we can still have that kind of society of these creatures that are like very anarchistic, you know, like each of the ships that we get the sense is sort of on its own in a culture-y kind of way. And they're like changing positions all the time and stuff. I just like that, you know, you were right, I think, looking back, that I love the Portids, but they are very humanish in their hierarchical ways, whereas the octopi really do feel alien. And that's fun.
And just deeply identifiable with how yeah. angsty and flighty and just like, ooh, shiny.
I can't wait for you to read book three because of the Paul stuff in book three. I'm not giving anything away there.
Right.
Like it carries on in the same way that the book two carries on in that sense. But the Paul stuff in there is, oh my God, you're gonna love it. Anyway, I suppose we should wrap a little bit for this first one, shouldn't we?
Yeah. Just so much tentacly goodness. And
yeah, and we have consciousness to talk about next time. All the different kinds of distributed, mm-hmm. and we're going to talk about the creature for now. So that's our preview for next time, I suppose, right? Is our...
Yeah. Really going on an adventure this time.
We're going to discuss what going on an adventure means. So yeah, I guess all that leaves us then is to thank some patrons.
Yeah.
As a human, I was ill-equipped to thank you. But as myself, you have my everlasting gratitude.
So we have some new patrons. We're going to start referencing our new patrons as we catch up on them. So thanks to Buoyant Citrus and Schreiberbike. Appreciate it. And of course, as always, thanks to our strong AIs that are a mix of ants and other things patrons. Corey Ebert, she packed my bags last night pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m.
Amazing.
That's great. That's killer. Big Easy Blasphemy, dude. A wise Zin once said, you can't be neutral on a moving train. It's very clever. Jesse Rabinowitz and Brenda Goodman, Alex Arnett, and our new Helping People Out patron, Jesta. And all the thanks to our absolutely, definitely not a clone that we thought out and pretended that it has the normal consciousness patrons, Alex Beneshek, and yelling at podcasters is para antisocial. That's good.
So good. So is it time to head down to the abandoned cargo bay and find out what else I'm excited for the octopi to do with their tentacles?
Yeah, you wanna go get uplifted? Thank you all so very much.
Thanks again to our listener units and patron units. Your support makes our internet broadcast possible. If you want to hear more from us, check out our other internet broadcasts, Queersplaining and Embrace the Void, as well as our wonderful editor Louisa Lyon's filmed live musicals podcast. Leave them all 5-star ratings and reviews on your podcast application. You can follow us on Twitter at @ZeroGPhilosophy or email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. If you want to support the show and get even more juicy sci-fi hot takes, consider joining the crew over at patreon.com/ZeroG. Just $2 a month gets you early access to episodes and after dark content. Until next time, friends, stay gooey.